Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently studying the book of Genesis, so open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
We are technically in Genesis 26 tonight. Last week, we talked about Isaac and Rebekah having two sons, twins in the womb, Jacob and Esau. And God saying, before the children were even born, while they were still in the womb, having done neither good nor evil, that Esau was going to serve Jacob, and that the progression of the seed was going to proceed toward Jacob and not toward Esau. God preferred Jacob over Esau. Now, there's one more place in the Bible where this idea of the preference of Jacob over Esau comes up. And we need to look at that tonight before we move on. And in fact, it is the very place that Paul got the phrase, Jacob have I loved and Esau have I hated. You may have noticed as we looked at it last week that that particular phrase isn't in Genesis 25. There is this preference to Jacob, and that Jacob was going to get the possession, the seed, the heritage, and that Esau was going to serve his brother. But you never saw the phrase, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. It seems like Paul sort of introduced that, except that it actually is an Old Testament phrase. So we need to look at that for a moment and see where that kicks in. So go to the very last book of the Old Testament. It's the book of Malachi. If you can find the New Testament, if you can find Matthew, go back one book because you're there. It's a very short book, a whole four chapters. And to give you some sense of time and place here, Malachi is writing during the time of Nehemiah, during the time of the rebuilding the temple. This is after the Assyrian captivity, and then the Babylonians have conquered the Assyrians, and then the Medo-Persians have conquered the Babylonians. And then, as Isaiah had predicted, Cyrus rose up into power, and Cyrus actually allowed the Israelites to go back to their land, particularly to go back and rebuild Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. Well, under Nehemiah, during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, this is that restoration period, rebuilding the temple, rebuilding Jerusalem. Malachi is written somewhere in that 425 to 450 BC period, about 100 years after the restoration project has begun. And when it began, there was a lot of enthusiasm. You know, say, hey, we're going back home. I'm sure a lot of them went, hey. But they said, hey, we're going back home, and we're going to rebuild the temple. We're going to rebuild Jerusalem. There was a lot of excitement, a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of activity going on. And, of course, Ezra discovers a copy of the law, and he reads it out to all the people, and there's this real restoration going on. Well, we're 100 years into that now by the time Malachi shows up. And things have been rough, and they've endured a drought. And not only that, the priesthood, the leadership, the Levites, over that 100-year period have become really lax. They started with all that vigor. Well, let's do it all God's way. Let's follow every little rule and bring him every little gift and do everything the way we're supposed to do it. Well, by the time Malachi comes around, even that wasn't being done properly, as is always the case. If God is slow to act, if people don't see the blessings right away immediately, they get bored and go, well, why am I doing this? What's in it for me? Where's the benefit? And that's exactly what had started to happen to Israel here. And we have to remember that the worship of God happens and occurs, the service of God takes place, not because of what we get out of it, but because of who he is. We serve God because he's God. And even if you serve him your whole life, and all he does is give you something to wear, something to eat every day, he's done his job. Anything you get above food and raiment is an extra blessing of his grace anyway. But people very commonly, when they don't get enough from God quickly enough, say, well, that's it, I'm not going to serve that God anymore. Things are not going my way. 100 years, the Israelites had gone back, had been rebuilding, had been looking for what they anticipated being this kingdom that they had heard so much about, all these promises, returning the second time. Now here Cyrus has let him go, just like Isaiah said he would. And they go back into the land, and they start working, and they start building. And 100 years goes by, and nothing big has occurred. And they start kind of going, well, why serve God then? We don't seem to be getting anything dramatic out of it, so forget it. Well, that's where Malachi enters the picture. He walks into that sort of unhappy, unfulfilled Israelite community. And he's going to start right out by asking them the question, where do you get this impression that God doesn't love you? He has already said, Jacob have I loved, and you are the descendants of Jacob. Therefore, he does still love you. And the evidence Malachi is going to use is that he said, Jacob have I loved, and Esau have I hated. And he's going to demonstrate that God's hatred is still on Esau. The implication being, if in fact Esau is still suffering under God's hand, then the other half of the equation must also be true. He must still love you, despite what your circumstances look like. So this also tells us then that the love of God, the graciousness of God, doesn't change because God doesn't change. And even if your circumstances don't necessarily look like God is loving you in the kind of way you would love to be loved, if that's in fact a sentence, because there's none of us who wouldn't love health, wealth, prosperity. There's none of us who wouldn't love to have no trouble every day and no health trouble and the money just keeps flowing in and everything you touch turns to gold. We would all like that, we think, but it is the struggles, the trials of life that create character and build a genuine dependency on God and form that relationship. And this is exactly what Malachi is struggling with if you go through the whole book. He's having to deal with the Israelites in a period where they're saying, well, God claims he loves us, but where is it? Where's this big love we've heard so much about? And he's going to remind them, well, he said, Jacob have I loved, but he also said, Esau have I hated. And as you'll notice, that hatred of Esau continues, which means the love continues too. Do you remember on Sunday I was pointing out that the first half of the Jeremiah promise in Jeremiah 31, where God said, the same way that I have looked after Israel to pull them down, to pluck them up, the second half of that sentence was, and I'll plant them and build them. And I said, we can see clearly, historically, unquestionably, the first half of that sentence is true. If the first half of that sentence is true, therefore the second half of that sentence is true. And just because God hasn't yet done the building, the restoring, the building up, doesn't mean he's not going to. And the evidence you have that he's going to is that he's already done the first half of the sentence. The plucking up and the scattering and the knocking down and all that stuff. Well, same thing with Malachi. That's exactly the logic Malachi is going to use here. That's where I get that logic, is Malachi is going to say, well, he must still love you because, look, the curse is still on Esau. And since he's still cursing Esau, he must still be loving you. Both half of the equation must be true, despite what your circumstances look like. Got that? So again, the big lesson in Malachi, and we're only going to read a little brief piece here, but the big lesson in Malachi is your circumstances do not determine God's love. God's character, his nature, his unchangeableness is what determines his love for you. And faith, real faith, genuine faith in God, doesn't view your circumstances. It views God, his character, the promises he's made, and then you walk through your life believing that what God has said is more real, more true than your circumstances. Because the circumstances of life will oftentimes make it look like God's not keeping his word. And we're so quick to go, hey God, I've had a really bad week, where are you? Like God, who is eternal and lives forever, and you know, 1,000 years is like a day, and so you have a rough week, which is a blink of an eye for God, and he's going, I'm still up here sustaining the universe. Didn't you eat? Aren't you still alive? Don't you know your name? You didn't suffer. You're not on the street. You're not. Where's your complaint here? But we look at it from the human side and say, well, I was unhappy for a little while. Where's God in all this? Faith says, God has said he loves us with an everlasting love. That love does not change just because our circumstances have changed. And in fact, it may be God's love that has brought about these difficult circumstances. Because we've all been through some tough circumstances, but I can guarantee you this, you've done more growing during your tough times than you ever did during your easy times. You come out a different person after going through the rough patches than when you go through an easy period. If you go through an easy period where you can just sit back and relax, eat, drink, be merry, when you go through those periods, you come out the other end just as dumb as you went in.
Sure, it's more fun.
It's more fun. You don't have to think about anything. You don't have to press toward God. You don't have to pray. It's all just flowing toward you. And so it's real easy to just take that in stride. That's just downhill coasting. nothing to it. But when the struggles of life come, when the trials of life come, those are the times you have to cling to God because you got nothing else. And those are the times that you have to believe that God knows what he's doing or you won't be able to get through it. Those are the times that you end up, by the time you come out of it, you've learned something about yourself, you've learned something about God's faithfulness, you've learned something about your own character and nature, and you've learned what's important in life. I was talking with John Jones today. He had a doctor appointment this morning that I had to take him to, and because he's blind from birth and, you know, needed somebody to drive him there. And I've known John for probably 16, 17 years. And so he called me a couple days ago and asked me if I could drive him up there. So I said, sure, and picked him up this morning, and got up at 7 and was there at his house at 8 and picked him up, and we drove down. 8:15, we're sitting in front of the doctor's office because he said his doctor's appointment was at 8:30. We're sitting in the parking lot, and the sign on the door says, Wednesdays, open at 9. We got 45 minutes to kill. And John starts apologizing profusely. Oh, I must have gotten confused. I'm sorry. I didn't know. And I said, John, before you go on any further, I got to tell you, I've been through some big stuff in my life. I have been through major, painful, catastrophic things in my life. And John, this isn't one of them. This is 45 minutes sitting in a parking lot. This is nothing. This is downhill coasting. The sun is on our shoulders. I mean, there's just nothing wrong with this. We're just happily sitting in a $20,000 vehicle in a parking lot waiting for you to see a doctor. What is wrong with this picture? Nothing. We're good. Don't worry, John. Don't apologize. This is good life. But there was a time in my life when a 45-minute wait would have made me nuts. 45 minutes wait. You made me get out of bed early and come here and get you so that I can sit in a parking lot in the sun for 45 minutes? I don't care that you got excuses. I don't care that you're coming. I'll tell you another story. Why not? I'm telling a story. We'll get to Malachi eventually. After everything that happened 3.5 years ago, you know, my whole life blew up and our family life and everything all kind of went haywire. And the kids were over at the house one night and I made a dinner for them. And we sat down and we're eating and James reached for something and he knocked over his glass of milk. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Knocked over his glass of milk. And I got up calmly and I went and I got a towel and I got some paper towels and here, wipe it up, wipe, wipe, wipe. And we put some more milk in the glass and I went back to eating. And James was just staring at me, aghast, and just like he's looking at a zombie. Like, what'd you do with my dad? And I said, what's the matter, James? And he said, you didn't get upset. I said, right, should I have? He said, well, this would have really upset you before. I spilled milk being clumsy during dinner. You would be really angry at me. Why aren't you? And that's exactly why. Perspective has changed. I've been through some big stuff. I've been through some big, important, painful stuff. As a consequence, spilled milk? Oh, whatever. There's nothing to that. Sitting in a parking lot for 45 minutes? That's a heyday in my book. Yeah, we're fine. I was riding with my friend Joe a few weeks ago. We were in Murfreesboro on the square, and we stopped to pull into a parking spot, and the guy behind us honked at us. In the little square where the speed limit is like 5, we stop, he honks. Well, my friend Joe turns to me and says, wouldn't you love to be him where the biggest trouble in your life, the biggest problem in your life was this? Wouldn't that be great if this is what it took to upset you? You know, everything in my life is so great, a stopped car makes me honk and get angry. But once you've been through some stuff, right, Gladys?
Yes.
You've been here a while.
Yes.
I mean, here by on the planet for a while.
Right.
You've lived some stuff.
Right. I was just telling them the anniversary of my graduation.
Right.
Which was?
61st.
Wow, 61st anniversary. Yeah. So the reality is, in life, it is the struggles, it is the trials, it is the difficulties that build character, but they also build your faith. They also cause you to cling to God, and you come out the other side of those problems better for having gone through it. You've learned a lot of important lessons, and it also creates in you what Paul talks about in the New Testament, that the trials of this life bring about patience. It's the word triedness. It brings about this triedness to your spirit, and that produces hope. And that hope maketh not ashamed. And that's the process. You're on that potter's wheel, getting formed, getting shaped, until God can produce that kind of hopeful expectation where when you go through your next problem, instead of going, oh no, this is going to kill me, you've been through so many that didn't kill you, you start going, well, this is going to be interesting. I wonder how God's going to get me through this one. Well, here comes another one. Yeah.
Can I share a story?
It's sure.
Been my story,
but no, my stories are so much better. I don't think we have.
It happened this week. Okay, so y'all know Melissa, and you know she has all these children, and she's by herself. And of course, what do children need? But they need two parents. They need a mama and a daddy. So Melissa's laying in her bed, and she hears this horrible knock on the door, and it's the police officer at the door saying, there's been a call for, you know, loud music being played, and I was walking around the building, and your upstairs window is open, and there's some kids up there playing a radio. So, you know, and she's like, well, I'm underneath them, and I can't hear it. So, but there, anyhow, there are a group of people down that live behind her who make a lot of noise.
Right.
And she's like, she walks upstairs, and she says, oh, boys, you don't have a daddy, but you have a daddy in heaven who sees what you're doing, and he has sent the police officer to tell me that you are busted. And so, anyhow, I just thought that that was interesting, because, you know, she's like, how do I keep these children in line when I'm overwhelmed, and they see it, and they just take advantage of the fact that mama's tired? And she told him that, she said, I got news for you, you've got a daddy in heaven who's going to tell on you every time.
He's going to watch over you.
You're never going to get away with it.
Yeah.
Just the trials, you know, she's overwhelmed.
Okay, I admit it. That was a good story.
That was a comfort to her.
It was.
She is going through a horrible trial right now. And to know that even the little minutiae, her little worries about how are these children.
Yeah.
And she's waiting on the Lord.
Huh? Waiting on the Lord.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
She's like, oh, they know what's up.
The book of Malachi, chapter 1, verse 1. This is the word or the oracle of the word of the Lord to Israel through Malachi. Malachi, by the way, is not a proper name. It means messenger. Nobody really knows for sure who the particular fellow was that wrote it. Verse 2 starts right in, quoting God. I have loved you, says the Lord. There's the declarative statement. I have loved you. Now, plenty of prophets up until now have said to Israel, I have loved you. Jeremiah 31:3, I've loved you with an everlasting love. Therefore, with loving kindness have I drawn you. They have plenty of promises from God that God loves them. I have loved you, says the Lord, but you say, how hast thou loved us? You claim to have loved us, but how? Look at our lives. Look what we've been going through. Look at the famine. Look at the difficulties with the priesthood. Look at what we're going through. How is it that you've loved us? Prove it. So his proof is, was not Esau Jacob's brother, declares the Lord? Yet I have loved Jacob, but I have hated Esau. So there it is. Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated. That's what Paul picks up in quotes in Romans 9. But I have hated Esau, and I have made his mountains a desolation. Okay, now he's reaching into their history and saying, the areas where the Edomites have dwelt and now dwell, the descendants of Esau, I have made a desolation, and I have appointed his inheritance for the jackals of the wilderness. And at that moment, that area of Edom was in fact a wilderness. So God is saying, okay, now remember, I've said I loved you. You said, wherein do you love us? Prove that you love us. His proof is, didn't God say, Jacob I've loved and Esau have I hated? Well, then to prove that he actually still loves you, let's take a look at what he's doing to Esau. Look at what he's done to Esau. He's laid him waste, and he has jackals living in the land that was supposed to be theirs. Though Edom says, verse 4, though Edom says, we have been beaten down, but we will return and we will build up our ruins, thus says the Lord of hosts, they may build, but I will tear it down. And men will call them the wicked territory and the people toward whom the Lord is indignant forever. Okay, there's God's evidence.
That's not good.
That's not good. Nothing about that is good. They will be called the people toward whom the Lord is indignant forever. You don't want to be wearing that on a t-shirt. No. Not a lot of t-shirts in Edom probably during that period anyway. But verse 5, and your eyes will see this, and you will say, the Lord be magnified beyond the border of Israel. This is very interesting, because They thought that God's entire magnification of himself was going to be demonstrated in Israel exclusively. And since we're the Israelites who you love, the only way God was going to get glory to himself and be magnified on the earth was going to be to glorify Israel in their mind, in their thinking. And they're saying, but look, we're not the chief nation. We're not being glorified. We're going through trouble. So where is the magnification of the Lord? God, why aren't you bringing glory to your own name by making us your people grand and great on the earth? And God said, I'm teaching you something. I'm teaching you to expand your thinking beyond your idea that the whole world centers around you. God is saying, I am doing according to my will and glorifying myself in the destruction of my ancient enemies. And therefore, I'll get glory to myself and be magnified beyond the borders of just what I do within Israel. In other words, everything God does in his universe, everything he does on this planet among all people groups is all designed for the same purpose. You've heard me say this over and over again. God is in the enterprise of glorifying himself. And he is going to glorify himself in blessing his people, protecting his people, providing for his people, teaching his people, bringing his people through tough times, delivering his people. He's going to do all that, yes, but he's also going to get glory for himself in the judgment of those who are not his people, who are his enemies, or who are enemies of his people. Both of those achieve his glory. Got that? So here's God saying, sure, yeah, you're going through a suffering period, but you know why? Because I'm glorifying myself in teaching you that it's not all about you. It's all about me. I'm going to be magnified and I'm going to get glory to myself. And if that means you got to go through 100 tough years, then you're going to go through 100 tough years, but I'm going to get the glory. That ought to help us arrange our thinking about who God is and what God is like. God is going to get glory to himself, even if that means taking you through all kinds of struggles and problems and trials. What did he take Job through?
Plenty.
I mean, could you have lived through that?
No.
Could you have lived through what Job went through? No, I don't think any of us could have endured that, gotten to the end of it and said, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. And he rose up and he tore his mantle and he shaved his head and he said, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And the next verse says, and in all this, Job sinned not with his mouth. Would have been real easy to sin with your mouth at that moment. You've lost everything. All your kids are dead. You've lost all your cattle and your wealth. Everything you have has been destroyed. And now he's sitting covered in boils, cutting himself open with a broken piece of pottery so that his boils can pus out. This is not pretty. If there was ever a time to go, I thought you loved me, God, this would have been a good time. His own wife comes to him and says,
that's
the only thing he's got left is his wife. And she seems to be the only one still intact. Several years ago at the conference in Lexington, Barney Johnson, whom we all love, preached a message up there called The Truth According to Mrs. Job. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
And he took that phrase that Mrs. Job came to Job, because she's never named, so she's Mrs. Job, came to Job and said, will you still retain your integrity? Curse God and die. And the truth, according to Mrs. Job, was she saw all that trouble as coming from God. She did not say, curse the devil and die. She said, all this happened to you, and this has to be God's doing. Why do you retain your integrity? Why won't you just curse God and die? And yet he tore his mantle, shaved his head, and said, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. The opposite of cursing him. Could you have done that? No. And then you get your three fair weather friends showing up who want to sit down and talk to you about how it's your fault when you know that it's not, you can't think of anything you've done. And, you know, the whole middle part of the book is this big discussion between the four of them where Job keeps insisting, no, this is just God doing what God does. And the other three are just pounding on him. Talk about power in numbers. The other three are ganging up on him and saying, this has to be something you did. God is fair. God's only going to work fairly. And he's only going to do this to you if you did something wrong. Why don't you admit that you did something wrong? And Job just finally gets to the end of it and says, if God was here now, I'd ask him why he did this, because I'm telling you, there's no reason found in me. And then God shows up and says, who is this that darkens my counsel without knowledge? Oh, well, that's another conversation that got off on a wrong foot right there. So, so back to Malachi, verse 5, your eyes will see this and you will say, the Lord is magnified beyond the borders of Israel. So Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated, is a key concept in Malachi's writing in promising Israel, in proving to Israel that God is still with them and God still loves them, and saying, look, he's still cursing Esau, so he must still be loving you. Now turn over to chapter 3 of Malachi for a moment. Because as I mentioned to you last week, one of the ways that people try to get rid of what Paul has said in Romans 8, where Paul has said, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated, and that this was said while the two children were still in the womb, having done neither good nor evil, so that the election of God would stand, so that the purpose of God by election would stand. Paul's very, very clear in his language saying that the reason Jacob was preferred had nothing to do with Jacob. After all, the two babies hadn't done anything yet. They're still in the womb. Nothing's been done. And then he says, so the purpose of election would stand, not of him that wills, nor of him that runs, but of God that shows mercy. So that we really understand that Paul was saying this has nothing to do with what the people did. But then the common explanation of that by the Arminian crowd is, well, God knew what the two nations were going to do that came from Jacob and Esau. They knew what the descendants of Jacob were going to do. They knew what the descendants of Esau were going to do. They knew that the Edomites, the Esauites, were going to be bad and that Jacob was going to be good. And therefore, he chose Jacob on the basis of what he knew was going to happen. He knew that he knew that Jacob's descendants, Israel, were going to follow God and believe in God. You know, and since he knew that, he chose them. Okay, well, let's test that theory for a moment. Because now we're reading in Malachi, after God has restored them, taken them into bondage, they have a long, rich history with God now. They have the deliverance out of Egypt. They've been brought into the promised land. They have this long history. So did the Israelites become good? Did they rise to the occasion? Because if they didn't, then that entire theory and explanation that says the reason God preferred Jacob was because he knew what they were going to do. They were going to be the good ones. The Esauites are going to be the bad ones. So Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated, was the result of God's foreknowledge of what they were going to be like and what they were going to do. That's the explanation. The problem is the history of Israel doesn't bear that out. But Malachi is going to take the time to explain why it is that God continued in his kindness to Jacob, despite the way they are. So he's going to describe Jacob. Chapter 3, let's just start at verse 1. Behold, I am going to send my messenger, and he will clear the way before me. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, and the messenger of the covenant in whom you delight. Behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. There's no doubt that this beginning of chapter 3 is a prediction of the Messiah to come. The Lord will come suddenly to his temple. But who can endure the day of his coming? So clearly there's judgment involved. And who can stand when he appears? For he is like a refiner's fire and a fuller's soap. In other words, he's going to be there to refine and to clean. And he will set as a smelter and a purifier of silver, and he will purify the sons of Levi and refine them like gold and silver, so that they may present to the Lord offerings in righteousness. In other words, as he just said, the Levites, I've already told you, had begun not doing things the right way. The priesthood had gotten lazy. So he's saying, I'm not giving up on the priesthood. Instead, Messiah is going to come and refine them, so that they can come and present in righteousness. Rather than give up on them for the way they're doing it, though he admits they're doing it wrong, nevertheless, the Messiah is going to perfect them. And the offering of Judah and Jerusalem will be pleasing to the Lord, as in the days of old and as in the former years. Verse 5, then I will draw near to you for judgment, and I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers, and against the adulterer, and against those who swear falsely, and against those who oppress the wage earner of his wages, and the widow, and the orphan, and those who turn aside the alien, and who do not fear me, says the Lord of hosts. None of these are good descriptions of what's going on in Israel. There's all this bad stuff going on in Jacob. So God should be judging Jacob. But look at the next verse. For I, the Lord, do not change, and therefore, O sons of Jacob, are you not consumed. Because God put his love on Jacob, by election, by grace, that's the reason Jacob was not consumed, despite being bad and evil. So get it right in your head. God did not prefer Jacob because he was good. God, in his grace, chose Jacob, and therefore Jacob, despite his evil, was not destroyed. So it, again, is all grace, 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 grace. And it's all through the Bible the same old way. For I, the Lord, do not change. Therefore you, O sons of Jacob, are not consumed. From the days of your fathers you have turned aside from my statutes. Notice that. He's not saying, you're the good ones. Esau ran off, but you stayed with my statutes. That's why I chose you from the womb, because you're the good ones. Instead, he's saying, you're bad, you're wrong, you're evil. You should be destroyed and consumed and judged. You have not kept my statutes. You have not kept them. Return to me, and I will return to you, says the Lord of hosts. But you say, how shall we return? And then he gets into, you've robbed God, bring all the tithes and offerings into the storehouse. We won't even get into that right now. Just go online and click to the read section and then go to my book on New Covenant giving and read about tithing versus giving by grace. That's all in the book. Are you getting a sense now of the whole Jacob Esau thing? Because I'm trying to be really clear and precise about it. It is all an act of grace. That's what Paul says in Romans 9. But it is considered to be an act of grace all the way through the Old Testament. And the last book of the Old Testament before Messiah appears says when Messiah comes, he's going to refine the priests so that they can serve in righteousness. You have not kept my statutes. You have not kept my laws. I should have destroyed you. But because I don't change, God speaking, because I don't change, I have not destroyed you. This is all a continuation of the Abrahamic covenant. I have loved you because you are the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It even calls him Jacob by name. By the way, they have been called Israel already. But there's a fair consistency to the fact that when God refers to them nationally and wants to point out to them what sinners they are, he calls them by heel catcher. He calls them by supplanter, just to really grind in the point that you are the sinners that I am saving. Every once in a while, he refers to them as Israel, prince that has power with God, when he wants to tell them about his blessing and the kingdom to come and Israel. But then times like this, when he wants to drive home the point that they are simply recipients of grace, he goes back and calls them by their original name. You're just Jacob. You're just heel catchers. You're just supplanters. You're just in the way. You're the type that will trip people up. You don't keep my statutes, but I don't change. And we ought to be really happy about the God doesn't change thing. Because that means if he has ever loved you, he has always loved you. And that doesn't change just because you are so unlovable. I didn't mean to look right at you at that moment as I said it.
That's all his promises stay good.
All his promises stay good, not based on us performing. His promises stay good based on his character. Because he is the everlasting, unchanging God, so every promise he has made to us stays good. I'm really glad about that, because if it were dependent on me being good for God to keep his promises to me, forget it, I'm a dead man.
You wouldn't have much hope.
No, who would? Nobody'd have any hope. None of us can perform. But this theology of God's sovereign grace is woven all through the Bible over and over again, and we just saw it in the very last book of the Old Testament. And by the way, it's just an interesting reality that the Old Testament ends with the word curse. And then you open up the New Testament, and here comes the solution to the curse. So it's all woven together. We're in Genesis 26. Go there.
I had a really fun revelation this past week, and not that I've never thought of it before, but just that it was brought into my attention again, that I get so frustrated talking to people about religion, and I just get so, like, just upset that people don't get it. And I'm just like, why don't you understand this? This is so blatant. This is so there. It's all the way through the Bible, you know, just arguing with people. And that right there is the proof, you know, that they can't hear it. And, you know, it's by the grace of God that I can understand it, and I thank God for that.
Yeah.
I can, but You know, that, again, this week was just a reminder to me that, you know what, they can't hear it because they're, they
can't. They can't hear it.
And, you know, you shouldn't be frustrated because there's nothing that you can do about it.
All you can do is tell the truth. And you have to be brave enough to not bend the truth to try to get them to hear something.
Right.
You have to stand on the truth, knowing that if God wants to open their minds and hearts, Jesus walked around constantly saying that he was speaking to those who had ears to hear and walking around talking in parables. They said, why do you speak in parables? And he said, so that they'll hear and not understand. So there are plenty of people that you can present the word to, and they can get the big stuff. Hey, there's this guy, Jonah, and he got on a boat, and he got swallowed by a fish, and he ended up in Nineveh, and they go, that's a great story.
And I believe in God.
Right.
Of course I believe in God.
Yeah. Most people do. Pressed to the wall, most people will tell you, I believe in God.
Yeah. But again, keep in mind that, John, you planted a seed.
Right.
And just like with me coming in contact with the doctrines of grace, my first introduction was one sermon 15 years before I ever showed up in this building. And the curiosity that I gained from that led me to this. You know, so it's like, and it's like everything opened up at that point. It was in God's time. It wasn't,
well, you could be Jeremiah and not have any conversation.
Jeremiah preached 30 years, never had a convert. Yep. All right, we're in Genesis 26. That was all introduction. It's 10 to 8, and I just got the intro out of the way, so.
Sorry, we're all sugared up.
Thanks to Jennifer's cake. We're pretty much hyper.
Yeah, it's graduation.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
Chapter 26, verse 1. Now there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine that occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, and the Lord appeared to him and said, I've been reading this the last 2 weeks, and I said this is the seventh recounting of the Abrahamic covenant in the Old Testament, and this is where you see all the Abrahamic promises being passed down to Isaac. In Isaac shall thy seed be called was the promise. Now God is telling Isaac, you get the whole Abrahamic covenant. It's not going to go to Ishmael. It's going to go to Isaac. The Lord appeared to him and said, do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I will tell you. Sojourn or stay as a pilgrim in the land. And I will be with you and I will bless you. For to you and to your descendants I will give all this land. And I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. So there it is. Everything I promised Abraham, you get. So even though God had told Abraham before he ever had Isaac, you and Sarah are going to have a son, and in him, in Isaac, your seed will be called. Now God is keeping that word all these years later to Isaac and saying, you get all the promises, you get the land, you get the covenant, in your seed is going to be the descendant that's going to bring great news to all nations. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven. I will give your descendants all these lands. By your descendants, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Well, that's the entirety of the Abrahamic covenant right there. And then in verse 5, because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge and my commandments and my statutes and my laws, and as I've pointed out repeatedly, if there were any conditions to the Abrahamic covenant, God said right there that those conditions are already met. So when he's giving it to Isaac, it is truly, genuinely, completely unconditional because he's already said, I'm giving it to you because your father already did all these things. So there's no condition put on Isaac where God said, I'd like to give you the covenant provided you'll do something. Instead, it's simply, I chose you, you're mine, I named you before you got here, I told your mom and dad, even though they were past childbearing, that I was going to be bringing you and that in you the seed was going to continue. So this is God saying, I'm completely in control here. Verse 6, so Isaac lived in Gerar. When the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, she is my sister. Any of this familiar? Talk about the fruit not dropping far from the tree. Yeah, I mean, just like dad did. He goes in and says, this is my sister, for he was afraid to say, this is my wife, thinking the men of this place will kill me on account of Rebekah because she's beautiful. Same thing as dad went through. And so I think what we're learning here is men just don't marry a beautiful woman. Then you don't have to lie. There you go. And it came about when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was caressing his wife Rebekah. Then Abimelech called Isaac and said, "Behold, certainly she is your wife. How then did you say she is my sister?" And Isaac said to him, "Because I said, lest I die on account of her." And Abimelech said, "What is this you have done to us? One of the people might easily have laid with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." Now these people have a history of this happening to them with Abraham. They remember when a curse fell from God because Abraham lied to them. Now here comes Abraham's son doing the same thing. I think it is interesting that Moses, who could have chosen any story to tell as he's writing the Genesis account, leapt right from Isaac got the Abrahamic covenant to Isaac lied. I don't think this is a mistake. I think he went right from he got the covenant and God spoke to him and God said, "I'm going to establish my covenant with you because Abraham, your father, did those things and so you get the covenant," right from that to, and oh yeah, he was just like Abraham. He went out instantly and lied. He's living up to his name immediately. So, verse 11, "So Abimelech charged all the people, saying, 'He who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death.'" So now he's protecting them. Why? Because he knows this is Abraham's son. Do you remember last time when Abraham did this? Do you remember how none of the women in the kingdom could have any babies because of them? So look, nobody touch her, okay? We want to be able to continue as a kingdom. Leave her alone. "Now Isaac sowed in that land, and he reaped in the same year 100-fold, and the Lord blessed him." So now God is making real obvious, as he's living among his enemies, among the people who do own the land, he's making obvious that God is blessing him, taking care of him, making him rich. Verse 13, "And the man became rich, and he continued to grow richer until he became very wealthy, for he had possessions of flocks and herds and a great household, so that the Philistines envied him. Now all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham his father, the Philistines had stopped up by filling them up with earth again. Then Abimelech said to Isaac, 'Go away from us, because you're too powerful for us.' As he grew in servants and household and animals and wealth," they started getting worried, because you may remember that his father was able to create a standing army that went in and took out all five of the kings of the plains. So they know that this family has a history of growing up into powerful family groups, and so they said, "You've got to go." Verse 17, "And Isaac departed from there, and he camped in the valley of Gerar, and he settled there. Then Isaac dug again the wells of water which had been dug in the days of Abraham." The reason this is so important, and the reason that Moses keeps bringing this up, is that these wells become markers. These wells become proof to them historically that this is the land promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. After all, this well was dug by Isaac, or this well was dug by Jacob. This is a very common way for Moses to identify that the land they've been delivered back into is the very same land that was promised them. So these wells are going to be given names, and they're all going to continue into Moses' time. In fact, yeah, we've got a moment. We'll get back to this. Turn to, John tells this story. In the New Testament, turn to John. You're going to be familiar with this story, but I'll point out a little detail you might not have seen before. John 4, I'm hoping. Yes, indeed. John 4. Speaking of Jesus, "When therefore the Lord knew that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself was not baptizing, but his disciples were, he left Judea and he departed again into Galilee." So he's leaving Judea, the southern kingdom. He's going into Galilee, his homeland. In order to do that, typically the Jews would travel around Samaria so that they didn't have to encounter the Samaritans, the half-breeds, the dogs. "But when he left Judea and departed again into Galilee, he had to pass through Samaria. So he came to a city of Samaria called Sychar, near the parcel of ground where Jacob gave to his son Joseph, and Jacob's well was there. See that importance there? Jacob had a well there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, was sitting thus by the well. Even in Jesus' day, the wells that had been dug by Isaac and Jacob continued to be identified as those. So now we know that this land that is later the land where the Samaritans dwelt, the land of Samaria, is the very same land of Canaan where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had dwelt and dug their wells and had their flocks and herds and everything else. So it's clear that you're talking about the exact same land. And then when Jesus carries on this conversation with the woman of Samaria, she's real emphatic about, well, this is the well that was given to us by our father Jacob. So even though she's a Samaritan, a half-breed, she's still connecting herself to the connection to Jacob. There came a woman of Samaria to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me something to drink, or give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food, and the Samaritan woman therefore said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask me for a drink since I'm a Samaritan woman?" And then John adds parenthetically, "For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans." So you can see the infighting that was still going on during Jesus' time between the half-breeds and the purest Jews. Jesus answered and said to her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that says to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him and he would have given you living water." And she said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with. The well is deep. Where then are you going to get this living water? You are not greater than our father Jacob." See how she connected it? "You are not greater than our father Jacob, are you, who gave us this well and drank from it himself and his sons and his cattle?" So that well of Jacob continued to be identified well into Jesus' time. So these are landmarks, is my point. Because as we continue through, now go back to Genesis 26, as we continue through the next portion of Genesis, you're going to see a lot of talk about wells and how the wells were given particular names. They are landmarks handed down through the generations of Israelites, identifying this as the very land that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob dwelt in, raised cattle in, dug wells in. Got it? Okay. And it's going to cause a quarrel, of course. They're going to argue over the wells. Starting at verse 18 of Genesis 26. Hope you kept your fingers there. "Then Isaac dug again the wells of water which had been dug in the days of his father Abraham, for the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham. And he gave them the same names which his father had given them." So again, you're naming the wells, you're making landmarks. "But when Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found there a well of flowing water, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with the herdsmen of Isaac, saying, 'The water is ours.' So he named the well Esek, because they contended with him." Esek is Hebrew for quarreling, arguing, contending. "And they dug another well, and they quarreled over it too, so he named it Sitna," which means contention, argument, disagreement.
Enmity.
Enmity, yeah. "And he moved away from there, and he dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it. So he called that one Rehoboth, for he said, 'At last the Lord has given or has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land.'" Rehoboth means room, space, a place to live. Nobody's quarreling with us about this one, so we're going to settle here. This is our well, the place of a room. "So then he went up from there to Beersheba. And the Lord appeared to him in the night and said, 'I am the God of your father Abraham.'" Notice how he identified him. I find it fascinating that God continues to do this through the Old Testament. That he identifies himself first here as the father of Abraham, later as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He wants to make sure that they understand right away, I am that God. I'm not one of those foreign gods. I'm not one of those fake gods. I'm not one of those gods you've heard about. Remember that Abraham, when he was called out of the land of Ur of the Chaldees, his father was an idol maker. Abraham would then probably have been an idol worshiper. False gods, other gods were very common in the Middle East. When God, the real God, Jehovah God, shows up, he's quick to say, "I am the God of your father Abraham. I'm not any mysterious god or fake god." The same way that Moses, when he saw the burning bush, God spoke to him out of the burning bush and said, "Go tell Pharaoh, let my people go," and he naturally asks, well, who should I say sent me? Which God would this be? He wants to know what God, and so God identifies himself as I am that I am. I am the God that exists. Unlike all the other Egyptian gods that do not exist, I'm the God that is. Go say the God that is sent me. So he shows up at night here speaking to Isaac and says, I am the Lord, I am God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham. How many times do we have to see this repeated over and over? God is saying, I'm going to do it because I'm God and because I promised Abraham I would do it. And that doesn't change. Christ appears on planet Earth because of a promise God made to Abraham. And all of the machinations of human beings and nations and wars and armies coming and going couldn't stop the fact that God kept the seed flowing from Abraham all the way to Christ. And it happened that way because God said he was going to do it. So, verse 25, so Isaac built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord. That phrase, called upon the name of the Lord, is just odd language. What it means is he worshiped God there. He called on that God instead of any other God. He identified himself with Yahweh, the real God, the Jehovah God. Called on the name of, worshiped that God. And he pitched his tent there, and there Isaac's servants dug a well. We're seeing a lot of that now, aren't we? Then Abimelech came to him from Gerar with his advisor Ahuzeth and Phicol, the commander of his army. And Isaac said to them, why have you come to me since you hate me and have sent me away from you? Now, this is interesting. They've come to make a political alliance because they've watched God bless him so quickly and so tremendously that they realize God is with this guy, the real God. And it would be good for us if we got on his side. Because if he ever decided to go to war with us, the real God would be on his side. So they come to make an alliance. Verse 28, and they said, we see plainly that the Lord has been with you. So we said, let there now be an oath between us, even between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you that you will do us no harm, just as we have not touched you and have done to you nothing but good and have sent you away in peace. You are now the blessed of the Lord. Can you imagine being so blessed of the Lord that even among your enemies it's so obvious that they would come to you and go, okay, it's clear that God's on your side. I think the emphasis Moses is putting here is God did exactly that. He made it so obvious that Isaac, because he was Abraham's descendant, was completely in God's hand. I think it'd be nice if Christians walked around in the world today and people actually said, you know, it's obvious that God is with you. But Christianity in so many ways has been worldlyized, if that's a word, that the world can't even see the difference anymore between Christianity and the world.
We don't acknowledge God.
Don't acknowledge God, right. So there's no identification of you are the people of God. And we ought to be making peace with you because you are the people of God. Instead, it's like, oh, those are the Christians. We can stomp all over them. Then he made them a feast. Isaac makes a feast for all of them that came out to him. And they ate and drank. And in the morning they arose early and they exchanged oaths. Then Isaac sent them away and they departed from him in peace. Now it came about on the same day that Isaac's servants came in and told him about the wells which they had dug and said to him, we have found water. So he called it Sheba. And therefore the name of the city was Beersheba, or the house of Sheba, to that day. And when Esau was 40 years old, now we've made a leap here. Suddenly we're talking about Esau. We're talking about Isaac. But Isaac is traveling with his family. So he would have Jacob and Esau with him. He has his sons with him. So as they've been traveling, they've settled. They've got some wells. They've got animals. He's very, very wealthy. But they're living in a land that is occupied by non-Abrahamic descendants. So Esau, his son, is 40 years old, and he married Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah. And in fact, that idea of these two foreign women that have been married by Esau is going to come up later when Isaac, after tricking his father, gets sent away, Rebekah's going to go to old blind Isaac and manipulate him one more time and use these two daughters to do it. And basically say, if our unmarried son, Jacob, marries women like the ones we already have, I don't want to live anymore. And so that encourages him to send Jacob to Laban, and we'll go from there to follow the seed. But that's part of how Rebekah is going to protect her favorite son after he's already stolen the birthright and Esau wants to kill him. She sends him to Laban to go get a wife to avoid the Canaanite wives.
They just sent Rebekah
on. Yeah, go Rebekah. Yeah. So these two women are going to become a real thorn in Rebekah's side, and she's going to use it to manipulate her husband. So, all right, so you got that big chunk of information? I know that was a whole lot of stuff tonight, but this Jacob-Esau connection is really, really important, and it shows up a lot in the New Testament. And if you take anything away from tonight, it's God blesses his people because he's God. And even if you go through tough circumstances, you have to have faith that God is still in control and knows what he's doing, and his love didn't change. Your circumstances changed, but they're ultimately going to be for your good. Why? Because all things work together for good to those who love God, who are the called according to his purpose. So now you can see where Paul could write those kind of things. He has that whole Old Testament history to prove it.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.